Exodus, chapter 34, verses 1 to 35, the 33rd talk in a series on Exodus, was presented by David Crabtree on March 4, 2018, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 31, Exodus 34, 1 through 35, accompanies this talk.
We'll be looking at Exodus chapter 34. So, as you'll recall, the Israelites were making their way through the wilderness. They reached Mount Sinai, where God had told Moses a long time earlier that he would be bringing them back there. And that's indeed where they came. And when they got to Mount Sinai, God offered to make a covenant with the people of Israel. He offered to make them a kingdom of priests and a holy nation if they would agree to obey him. And they agreed to obey him. And so they had a ceremony to seal the agreement. And Moses, they had that agreement, they had that ceremony. Then Moses went up onto the mountain to talk with God and to receive further instructions as to how they were to build the tabernacle that God wanted them to build. While he was up there, he's up there for 40 days and 40 nights, and at the end of those 40 days and 40 nights, God told Moses that the people had rebelled and had built an idol, and God was going to destroy the people of Israel. But God mediated and established a restoration of the relationship. And at the end of that, then, after the relationship is restored, there is a reaffirmation of that covenant, and that's what we'll be reading about in this chapter. And as we'll see, there are some differences between when the covenant is initially made and the ceremony that's conducted there, as compared to what happens when it's reaffirmed in this chapter. And it's those differences that I'm going to be talking about at the end. I think they're significant. Okay, chapter 34, first 9 verses. Now the Lord said to Moses, "Cut out for yourself 2 stone tablets like the former ones, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets which you shattered. So be ready by morning, and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai, and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. And no man is to come up with you, nor let any man be seen anywhere on the mountain. Even the flocks and the herds may not graze in front of that mountain." So he cut out 2 stone tablets like the former ones, and Moses rose up early in the morning and went up to Mount Sinai, as the Lord had commanded him. And he took 2 stone tablets in his hand. And the Lord descended in the cloud and stood there with him as he called upon the name of the Lord. Then the Lord passed by in front of him and proclaimed, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin, yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the 3rd and 4th generations. And Moses made haste to bow low toward the earth and worship. And he said, "If now I have found favor in thy sight, O Lord, I pray, let the Lord go along in our midst, even though the people are so obstinate, and do thou pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as thine own possession." It says here that God said to Moses, "Cut out for yourself two stone tablets." When I was looking at that, that struck me because previously it seemed to me that it had been emphasized that God was the one who created the tablets. And here it says that God told Moses to cut out the tablets. And that is a difference, and it struck me as being a significant difference. Let me go through and just read these verses where it describes what had happened before when the covenant was first made, and then contrast that with this time. In Exodus 24:12, it says, "I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction." That's God speaking. Exodus 31:18, "He gave Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written by the finger of God." Then Exodus 32:15-16, "Then Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets which were written on both sides. They were written on the one side and the other, and the tablets were God's work, and the writing was God's writing engraved on the tablets." It seems to me that those passages are stressing the fact that these are the work of God, the tablets and the writing on them. In this chapter, it seems to paint a little bit different picture. As I just read in verse 1, it says, "Now the Lord said to Moses, cut out for yourself two stone tablets like the former ones." So here, Moses is clearly called upon to make the tablets themselves. Then later it says, "I will write on the tablets." That's God speaking. However, later it says in verse 27, "Then the Lord said to Moses, write down these words." So there it's Moses is the one that's writing. So it would appear that Moses is definitely the one that cut the tablets out the second time. And it's possible that he also was the one who wrote on the tablets. Now, why would there be this difference? We'll talk about this later, but I think that this is significant. This is a change that's significant between the two, between the initial making of the covenant and then the reaffirmation of the covenant. Okay, other aspects of this reaffirmation. No one is supposed to go up on the mountain. It's only Moses alone is supposed to go on the mountain. No one's supposed to go with him. There isn't supposed to be any livestock on the mountain. And Moses did all that he was told to do. He gets up early and he goes up on the mountain. When he goes up on the mountain, then God appears to him, and he appears to him as he had described in the last chapter. Moses had asked to see God's glory, and God said that he would pass his goodness before Moses. But Moses wouldn't see his face. Moses would only see his back. Well, now we have the fulfillment of that promise that God had made to show himself to Moses. And it describes God coming down in a cloud, and that's a common image that we see in the Old Testament. He comes down in a cloud, and he stood with him as he, Moses, called upon the name of the Lord. Then the Lord passed by in front of him. So apparently he passed by just as he had said he would, that his back is visible. And Moses sees that. But then God speaks. He proclaims. He says, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgressions, and sin. So we don't have a description here of what God's back looked like. We don't have a description of what Moses saw. But we do have a description of what God himself proclaimed. And what God proclaims is a series of moral qualities. That he's compassionate and gracious. That he's slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth. And he keeps loving kindness, loving kindness and truth, loving kindness there is chesed, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin. Amazing, amazing qualities. And these are qualities that all of which, to one degree or another, we have already seen him manifest in the book of Exodus in his dealings with the Israelites. And it struck me that this is interesting because the God of the Old Testament is often contrasted with the Jesus of the New Testament, as if they have very different qualities, features. But it's striking to me that these are the kinds of features that we do associate with Jesus. So the God of the Old Testament, certainly in his own estimation, is the same kind of God, has the same kind of character that Jesus does in the New Testament. And it's striking to me that there is no mention here of God's power. One would think that the most striking attribute of God would be his omnipotence, his omniscience, his grandness in that sense. But that's not what God talks about. It's true, but that's not what he talks about. That's not first on his list of the things that characterize him. The first things on his list that characterize him are his graciousness, his patience, his ability to forgive. It goes on, yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. This passage is puzzling in that it makes it sound like God punishes the future generations for the sins of the fathers. And there are other places in the Old Testament where it indicates otherwise, that God doesn't punish the children for the sins of the fathers. My best guess is that what's going on here is God is talking about his relationship to Israel as a people group, as a community. And there's a sense in which God relates to that community like he relates to a person. That community, there's a lot of continuity there, that community, it has a certain character, and that character persists over a period of time. And God relates to that community like he relates to a person over time. And as a result, there is a sense in which it is fitting and proper that he would punish the sins of that community when the time is right. and it may be in future generations. We certainly see that something like the Babylonian exile was a delayed punishment for sins that had been accumulated over a long period of time, over generations. So I suspect that's what's going on, but what is clear is that God is one who takes justice seriously. He is gracious, he's merciful, he forgives people of their sins, but he is a just God. And that is an integral part of his personality, his character as well. And sin will be punished. Okay. Moses then, having heard this, he repeats his request that he had made before. So now he's getting it on the record. He's getting it as a part of this reaffirmation proceeding. And his request was, "If now I have found favor in thy sight, O Lord, I pray, let the Lord go along in our midst, even though the people are so obstinate. And do thou pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as thine own possession." Those are the very things that he had been asking for in his negotiations with God after the incident with the golden calf. He wanted to get full reconciliation between God and the Israelites. And he lists that again. He wants God to go in their midst. That was a very important thing for Moses. And that's what this ceremony is reaffirming. Okay. Next section. Then God said, "Behold, I am going to make a covenant. Before all your people, I will perform miracles which have not been produced in all the earth, nor among any of the nations. And all the people among whom you live will see the working of the Lord, for it is a fearful thing that I am going to perform with you. Be sure to observe what I am commanding you this day. Behold, I am going to drive out the Amorite before you, and the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Watch yourself that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land into which you are going, lest it become a snare in your midst. But rather, you are to tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and cut down their Asherim. For you shall not worship any other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and someone invite you to eat of his sacrifice. And you shall take some of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters play the harlot with their gods, and cause your sons also to play the harlot with their gods. You shall make for yourself no molten gods." This section from verse 10 until 28 is all very similar to a section that we've already seen in Exodus. It's Exodus 23:20-33. Most of the wording is the same. In most cases, it's exactly the same sentences. But some of the sections have been moved around, and even some of the sentences have been moved around. So it's been reordered, but it's the same wording. And we'll talk more about that later. He starts out by saying that there will be unprecedented miracles, and that the surrounding peoples will witness these wonders. In Exodus 23, it has a fairly long section there talking about God sending his angel to help them along the way and to help them to drive out the Canaanites. And then it has another fairly long section talking about how God will bless them when they get into the land. So those lengthy parts have been omitted here, we just have this initial statement about God performing these wonders. And I think that's wonders as they move in and take control of the land. So it's talking about things like the crossing of the Jordan and the conquest of the city of Jericho. Then the next section is one in which in this section then, it does have a portion which tells them things that they are not to do. Starting with verse 12, watch yourself that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land into which you are going, lest you become a snare in their midst, lest it become a snare in your midst. Rather, you are to tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and cut down the Asherim. So we have a little section here of things that they are told not to do. Then it goes on, there is more, as we see at the end of this passage. They are to destroy the religious sites. They are not to be seduced into sacrificing to their gods. They are not supposed to eat meat sacrificed to the other gods. They are not supposed to intermarry. All of this is an expansion on the few sentences in chapter 23 with respect to worshiping idols. So this chapter, 34, has expanded that significantly and list of things that they are not to do when they go into the land. And then the last verse, don't make any molten gods. That's plainly in response to what they had done with the golden calf. And Exodus 23 has no corresponding section to that. So it starts out with that section, and now it's going to go on to talk about things that they must do. And once again, this repeats a section in Exodus 23. Starting with verse 18. You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread. For 7 days you are to eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month of Abib. For in the month of Abib you came out of Egypt. The first offspring from every womb belongs to me, and all your male livestock, the first offspring from cattle and sheep. And you shall redeem with a lamb the first offspring from a donkey. And if you do not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. You shall redeem all the firstborn of your sons, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. You shall work 6 days, but on the seventh day you shall rest. Even during plowing time and harvest you shall rest. And you shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks, that is, the first fruits of the wheat harvest, and the Feast of Ingathering at the turn of the year. 3 times a year, all your males are to appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel, for I will drive out nations before you and enlarge your borders, and no man shall covet your land when you go up 3 times a year to appear before the Lord your God. So it had talked about, in the previous section, it had talked about God helping them go into the land and then the practices that they are not to engage in, the idolatrous practices. Now it tells them what they are supposed to do. And the list of things that they are supposed to do is to carry out the feast that God had commanded them to observe. It starts out with the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is the Passover. Then it talks about offering up the first of the offspring. That is apparently talking about the Feast of the First Fruits, which, as I understand it, is the third day after Passover proper. That feast is not included in chapter 23, interestingly. Then it moves on to talk about the Sabbath. It's important to keep the Sabbath. In chapter 23, it had talked about the Sabbath year. Here it does not talk about the Sabbath year. It only talks about the weekly Sabbath. And then it moves on to the week of feasts, and then the feast of ingathering, or Sukkot. So it's all of the major feast periods are supposed to be kept. And it's stressed here, 3 times a year all your males are to appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel. So at those 3 feast periods, they are supposed to appear before God. Then it goes on to say, don't use the fact that someone might attack you during those feast periods to not go up and celebrate that God is going to make sure that no man covets their land during those times. So they're free to go. I think it's interesting, we've got the first one that's mentioned is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The second one that's referred to is the Feast of First Fruits. Then it's the Sabbath. And then it goes on to Pentecost and Sukkot. Why in that order? That's the order in which they are presented in Exodus. That they are told to celebrate the first one, Passover, and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then later, when manna is provided, then he talks about Sabbath. Then after that, we have the Feast of Weeks is really never explained in Exodus, and the Feast of, and then Sukkot is never really explained in Exodus, but those come afterwards. Okay. The next few verses, 25 and 26. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor is the sacrifice of the feast of the Passover to be left over until morning. You shall bring the very first of the first fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. These two verses occur in chapter 23 with only two word substitutions. And those are not, I don't think those are meaningful differences. So this passage occurs with this wording in this order in chapter 23. And as I talked about then, I think that Umberto Casuto is right, that this is referring to Canaanite practices that they are not supposed to adopt. That apparently there was a Canaanite practice of blood mixed with leavened bread. And apparently there was a Canaanite practice of having their feast days last throughout the night and into the morning. There was a Canaanite practice of offering first fruits to the Canaanite gods. And there is some evidence that there was a Canaanite practice of a fertility practice of cooking a lamb in its mother's milk. I think that's the best explanation that I know of for those four verses, that it's specifically targeting Canaanite rituals that the Israelites were not supposed to adopt. Okay, so this section from, as I said, this section from verse 10 through 28 is almost all in chapter 23. And what was happening there is that was the last thing that God said to Moses before the covenant was consummated, before there was the ceremony for the sealing of the covenant. Now this is the thing that is said, the only thing that's repeated in the reaffirmation of that covenant. The order has been changed. In Exodus 23, it was the things that you should do first, then the four special prohibitions, then the things that they should not do, and God's help in the conquest. Here in 34, it was the things that they should not do and God's help in the conquest first, then the things that they should do, that is, carry out the feasts, and then the four special prohibitions. Okay. My best guess is that God pulled this particular part of all that he had said before the first covenant. He pulled this out and repeated it because of the incident with the golden calf. That this is all God's plan for helping the Israelites to avoid the trap of idolatry. McKay, one of the commentaries that I consult, says it seems probable that the demands of the covenant that are reiterated here have been selected because they refer to offenses already committed by the Israelites in their apostasy. Okay. Now, the question, how does this instruction help the people avoid idolatry? We'll talk about that later in the conclusion. Verses 27 and 28. Then the Lord said to Moses, write down these words, for in accordance with these words I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did not eat bread or drink water. And he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. So God had Moses write this down. I assume that that means that on this tablet, it's Moses himself who actually recorded it. So Moses cut them out, and Moses wrote down the words on the tablet. And these are the words which God says, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. And we'll come back to that. He was there 40 days and 40 nights, during which time he doesn't eat any bread or any water. And he does as he was told. He writes down the words of the commandment. The Ten Commandments are written on this tablet. Next section, last section. And it came about when Moses was coming down from Mount Sinai, and the two tablets of the testimony were in Moses' hand as he was coming down from the mountain, that Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because of his speaking with him. So when Aaron and all the sons of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. Then Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the rulers in the congregation returned to him. And Moses spoke to them. And afterward, all the sons of Israel came near, and he commanded them to do everything that the Lord had spoken to him on Mount Sinai. When Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. But whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would take off the veil until he came out. And whenever he came out and spoke to the sons of Israel what he had been commanded, the sons of Israel would see the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face shone. So Moses would replace the veil over his face until he went in to speak with him again. There's a very curious little episode. Moses comes down from the mountain, having been there for 40 days and 40 nights, and apparently Moses is unaware of this, but his face shines. And apparently it shines quite brightly. There's something about it that makes it frightening to the people of Israel. They see it shining, and it causes them to shrink back in fear. And God, Moses has to call them in. First, he calls in the leaders, and he tells them what God had told him. And then he calls in the people and he tells them what God had told him. So he has told everybody what God had spoken to him on the mountain. But when he's done, he puts a veil over his face. And apparently it's because it is too disturbing for the people of Israel to see Moses with the glow on Moses' face. And I'm not sure exactly what's so disturbing about it, but my guess is it's the same thing that was disturbing when they heard the voice of God speaking to them directly on Mount Sinai. That there's something about that direct contact with something divine that is frightening to them. And as a result, it would appear to be, in a sense, an act of kindness on Moses' part to cover his face so that they don't have that frightening thing in their midst. So Moses develops this practice. Whenever he goes into to meet with God in the tent of meeting, he takes the veil off and he speaks to God directly. But whenever he comes out in order to protect the people, he puts the veil back on and then speaks to the people. A curious practice. Okay. There are a couple of things that I want to talk about in conclusion to this chapter. The first one is God's instruction that he gave to them was clearly targeted to help them with respect to idolatry. And the question is, how does this help with respect to idolatry? First of all, the things that he told them to do positively, that is, to celebrate the feasts and to celebrate the Sabbath. It seems to me that God is insisting that they celebrate these feasts because these feasts have significance. They have meaning. First of all, they have historical significance. And I think that this is very important. They have historical significance in that they are reminders of things that God has done. Now, I have argued before, and I admit that I appear to be in a very tiny minority, but I think that all of the feasts map on to events in the book of Exodus. That every one of them is representative of something that happened in the book of Exodus. And as a result, they all have a historical referent. A historical referent that they are supposed to remember because those are things that God did. And they're all significant. They're something concrete that they can hold on to. Something that it really happened. And it was an act of God that tells them much about who God is. That is certainly the case with the Passover, if it's not with the rest of them. The feasts also become theological reminders of who God is and what life is all about. The feasts are an occasion for reflection on who God is. Who is this God? And what is he doing in our midst? And the feasts are also, as I understand it, they also are feasts that are timed to coincide with the Canaanite festivals. All of the three feast times have an agricultural significance. I talked about that before, and we'll probably talk about that again in a couple weeks. They have an agricultural aspect, and it is believed that these started out as agricultural festivals, And they started out as agricultural festivals in Canaan. So God has provided festivals at each of those three times when there were Canaanite festivals as an alternative, as a replacement for those festivals. The Israelites were to celebrate at the same time, but they were to celebrate differently and before a different God. So I think that's what's behind the positive commands that were given to them, the things that they were commanded to do. Now, what's behind the commands of what they were to not do, that they were to avoid? It seems to me that what God wants to do is to establish some cultural taboos. These are practices that would be culturally, they would come to be seen as things that are unthinkable, things that it wouldn't occur to someone to do. And it seems to me that taboos can be a very healthy and helpful thing to have in a culture. I lose track of what kinds of things I have said in this series and what I have said elsewhere. So forgive me if this is stuff that I've already talked about in here, but I don't think I've talked about this. Back in the 60s, for those of you who can remember, for those who can't remember, take my word for it. But in the 60s, there was much talk about how traditions were a negative force in our culture. And it was argued that just because something is traditional, it doesn't mean that it should be done. In fact, the thinking was, it probably should not be done. We are breaking free from those things. We are forging a new life and understanding the world differently. And there was kind of this mentality that anyone who's over 30 is so tied into their ways that they really can't see straight. They can't see clearly and think clearly about life. It's only someone who's 30 years or old or younger that can see life clearly. And part of our job is to strip society of those traditions, get rid of that garbage. And I would have to say that I was impacted by that. That some of that, not all of it, but some of that seemed right to me. But I'm older. I'm over 30. And a few years ago, I read Edmund Burke's book, Reflections on the French Revolution, which was very interesting. I found it very helpful. In that book, he's talking about what's happening in France in the French Revolution. And in the French Revolution, they're just overthrowing everything traditional in France. They're getting rid of that, and they are starting afresh, starting anew, forging their own way and doing it much more intelligently than their predecessors had done. And Edmund Burke says, that's crazy. He says, the one thing that you have to keep in mind about traditions is they're time-tested. He says, and generally it's the case that those traditional practices and beliefs, they develop over a long period of time and they are refined over a long period of time, and they are retained and refined towards a goal that is positive and good. So he says, to just go around and overthrow traditions is and replace them with something that's never been tried is the height of folly. So he refers to traditions as wisdom without reflection, which I think is, it was really striking to me. That's very interesting. Wisdom without reflection. And it seems to me that taboos can serve that same purpose. That taboos that grow out of a healthy environment, good taboos, can be really, really helpful. As we're making our way through life, there are all kinds of decisions that we have to make. And for there to be some things that we wouldn't even consider doing, if those things are bad, those kinds of taboos are fantastic. It takes those off the plate. We don't have to worry about it. So it seems to me that taboos, like traditions that grow out of a healthy society, that have a healthy basis, are phenomenal. They're a huge help for anyone who's growing up in that culture. I know that I've mentioned this, but I can't help but repeat this particular thing. I read a book called Laws by Plato, and there's a passage in there that was really striking to me. He says, he's talking about the laws in the various Greek city-states, and he says, there are laws in every city-state against adultery, and it happens all the time. There isn't a single city-state that has a law against incest, and it never happens. That's because incest is a taboo, and taboos are much stronger than laws. And that's his point. Taboos, however, they need a lot of cultural support. You need a lot of unanimity. Otherwise, those taboos can be eroded away. If they start to erode away, that can snowball. I was just thinking about this, and I'll tell you why I was thinking about this. I listened to a lecture by a man who was the editor of Ramparts. I can't remember, Peter Collier, I think his name was. He was the editor of Ramparts magazine, and he gave a lecture where he was talking about the development of the new left. And so he was talking about the 60s and the thinking behind that and how it developed and unfolded. And as he was talking, I was thinking about this stuff. He since has come to, he's changed his perspective dramatically as someone who's over 30. But I was thinking, in my generation, it seems to me that the dismantling of taboos has become a science. We have dismantled so many taboos, we're really good at it. And my guess is that all of you could tell me what the steps are. But I just listed some of those. Whatever taboo it is, I'll call it X. The first thing you want to do is find the least offensive forms of X. So whatever it is, find the least offensive ones, and you want to highlight those. You want everybody to see those. They aren't so bad. The next, you have sympathetic practitioners of X. You want grandmas who do X. You want nice, clean-cut people who do X. And you want everybody to see that. Then you want to publicize how many people do X. Lots of people do X. They didn't do X. You don't know that they do X because they've been hiding it. But lots of people do X. Then you need to stress that people who say X is bad are narrow-minded bigots. And if when you've done that, then X is going to be seen as commonplace, and X is no longer taboo. Everybody does it. It's all over the place. And we've seen that done with, I mean, I was thinking of about eight or nine things that I could list where when I was young, those were taboos, and they are no longer. So what God seems to be doing is setting up positive practices, remembering who God is and what he's done for us. And on the other hand, taboos, practices that no one should do, no Israelite should do them, and all of those are practices that are conducive to idolatry. But of course, that is not the recipe for a righteous society. You may have a society in which they don't do these idolatrous practices and that they practice all of the feasts, but it's not going to create righteousness in and of itself. Anyone can keep the festivals and maintain the taboos and still be rebels against God. But it has become increasingly clear to me that good cultural parameters can encourage spiritual health. And it has also become increasingly clear to me that cultural pressures are very difficult to withstand and we need all the help that we can get. Okay, the other thing that I want to talk about is the differences that we see between the covenant when it was made initially and the reaffirmation of the covenant that we see in this chapter. Now, as I told you, the reason I started thinking about this was noticing that it says that Moses was supposed to make the tablets when there was so much emphasis on when the covenant was originally made that God made those tablets. He made them and he wrote on them. They were the work of God. Here, Moses seems to be the one who is creating those things. So I started thinking, well, what's the difference? What are the differences between the two, the making of the covenant originally and the reaffirmation of the covenant here? There are a lot of things that could be listed here as differences. There are a number of things that happened when the covenant was made in that ceremony that are not repeated in this chapter. The building of an altar, making a sacrifice, sprinkling blood, having a meal together, etc. My assumption is that those things had been done. It's assumed that those are in force and they don't need to be repeated. So now I'm going to look at the differences, things that are done differently. The first one is Moses made the tablets, and I've talked about that. The second is, there is no indication that in this reaffirmation of the covenant that the elders were present. If you look at Exodus 24, 1 and 2, it said, "Then he said to Moses, 'Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Moses alone, however, shall come near to the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people come up with them.'" So the picture, when the covenant was first made, is that the elders and these other individuals mentioned, they are to come up partway up the mountain, and then Moses alone goes up to the top. Here in the reaffirmation, it's just not as clear exactly what's happening. It just says in verse 3, and no man is to come up with you. So is there a difference there? It's not clear. The third thing, God appears only to Moses in this chapter. In Exodus 24, 9 through 10, it says, then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky itself. So there is an appearance of God before all those people. It's a different appearance. All they really see is the pavement under God's feet. Here in the reaffirmation, verse 5 and 6, it says, and the Lord descended in the cloud and stood there with him as he called upon the name of the Lord. Then the Lord passed by in front of him and proclaimed, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, etc. We also know from chapter 33 that God was going to show his back to Moses. But I think it's significant that in the first one, God appeared to all of the leaders of Israel. In the reaffirmation, he's appearing only to Moses. The fourth thing, Moses' face is glowing when he comes down from the mountain. There's no indication that that happened in the first covenant, but it happens this time, and it seems to be significant, and it seems to be novel. Seems to be new. And the fifth thing, the covenant this time is made with Moses and the Israelites. I went back and looked through the description of the covenant when it was first made, and there is no place where it explicitly says that God is making this covenant with X. But the context seems to make it clear that he's making it with the people of Israel as a whole. In this chapter, it says specifically, write down these words, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel, and speaking to Moses. Okay, what do we make of that? It seems to me that all of these things that are done differently, they all serve to highlight the role of Moses. Moses is really significant here. He's more important than he had been when the covenant was originally made. And it seems to me that what we're being shown is that there's a sense in which Moses is kind of like the co-signer on a loan. God is willing to reaffirm this covenant because of Moses. And so he has an elevated status that he had not had before. And Israel has Moses to thank for the fact that the covenant is still in place. I don't think that there's any indication here that the covenant has changed. The covenant is the same covenant that was there before. This is just a reaffirmation. But it's because of Moses that God is willing to reaffirm it. Okay. Any questions or comments?
The reaffirmation of the covenant with Moses, it seems reminiscent to me in some ways with the way that God dealt with Abraham. I mean, there's this situation where God makes promises to Abraham, and Abraham does something, and then he has to promise him again, and then Abraham does something again, and then he promises mm-hmm. him again. It's like this mm-hmm. whole series of taking Abraham through, look, I'm promising you this, and the promises sort of change a little bit as things go through. And it seems like... Right. It's almost like that's the way God works with his people. Like, I'm telling you what you should do, but I've got a built-in backup plan when you fail, because I'm going to have to re-up the covenant again. And I don't know. I'd be interested to know whether or not God reaffirms his covenant with David after he fails or any of those things. I don't remember the stories well enough, but I'm wondering if that is similar in that situation.
No, I recognize that phenomenon with Abraham. It seems to me here, though, and I think you're right, that I would have to look to see if it's true every time, but it does seem to get changed a little bit. Things get added as he's talking with Abraham, and so the promise kind of grows. I don't see any indication that in this case the covenant is changing, but that reaffirmation is true, and that seems to be a common phenomenon. Yep.
There's no mention of adultery or false witness or theft or murder in the reaffirmation of the covenant. Why is that?
Right.
Do you think?
The only things that are here are things that are specifically directed towards idolatry, it seems to me. And that's why I'm taking the inclusion of the feasts, it seems to me, are all towards that same end. So I'm interpreting all of this that's given in that context. It's all God addressing the problem that had occurred right after the covenant was made.
Presumably they're on the tablets, though, so implicitly.
Yeah, I don't... the Ten Commandments, absolutely. Okay, thanks.